The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodkey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the September-October 2025 issue. We begin with our feature story, Shedding Light on Luminescence. Research into the origins of bioluminescence suggests that the adaptation is more than meets the eye, having evolved at different times and in different ways throughout Earth's history. My home in Indiana sits at the edge of a small woods. Far away from any city lights, these woods come alive when the sun sets in the summer, twinkling with a gentle, rhythmic glow. This dancing light show marks the arrival of the fireflies. Against the backdrop of darkness, these floating bugs flash in and out of sync, mimicking the soft gleam of candlelight. I send my children outside to catch the fragile creatures, showing them how to cradle the beetles in their palms, letting the bugs flash between their fingers. An animal that produces its own light summons a visceral feeling of awe. Light empowers. Light transforms. Perhaps it's our human-centric way of understanding the world, as creatures who rely on sight above all other senses, to attach such importance to light. But throughout the natural world, we see organisms making their own glow, not by discovering electricity, as humans did, but by using the proteins in their bodies to gleam in the darkness. This phenomenon, called bioluminescence, reveals itself in the depths of the ocean, the hush of the night, and the hum of the rainforest. Spread across thousands of species, from fireflies to the firefly squid, bioluminescence has long been the subject of study. But research into its origins reveals that it is much more than a single adaptation. The glow of a beetle differs from the gleam of a cephalopod, with both tracing back to different evolutionary events. And the same holds true for other life forms, which developed bioluminescence on their own time and in their own ways. The lives and lights of these organisms thus tell a remarkable tale of evolutionary fate and ecological finesse, a story that illuminates their world as well as our own. Of course, the coordinated light shows of the firefly aren't just for aesthetic pleasure. They're a language that fireflies have developed to communicate with each other. For these nocturnal insects, light is a way to exchange signals of courtship and attraction. Each flicker is a flirty declaration of interest. Fireflies also engage in synchronized displays, turning their collective glow into a mesmerizing spectacle that may help them identify members of their own species and may contribute to the intricacies of their reproductive rituals. The pulsating rhythm of firefly gatherings is a living testament to the complexity of communication in the natural world, where creatures connect with flickers and flashes. The glow of the firefly is also about survival. Fireflies contain chemicals known as leucobufagins, which are unpalatable and even toxic to certain predators, deterring them from eating the glowing beetles. Many fireflies synthesize leucobufagins from chemicals they acquire in their diet, with the bright glow communicating their chemical defenses to those who might consider them a potential meal. And while some fireflies use light to fend off predators, others use it to attract prey. In their larval stage, fireflies lurk in the leaf litter and soil, and their bioluminescent glow serves as a trap for unsuspecting beetles, snails, and other small invertebrates. It's a strategy that blends the allure of light with the art of predation. Yet the story of firefly bioluminescence doesn't end there. The light even plays a role in their navigation of their surroundings. As these insects flit through the night, the rhythmic patterns of their glow help them orient themselves and avoid collisions. Their light is a celestial GPS system crafted by Evolution, a built-in feature that enables fireflies to navigate with precision. These stunning lights are thus a testament to the adaptability of life on our planet, where a twinkling glow can be a means of communication, defense, predation, and navigation. The light of the firefly is not a new discovery. Bioluminescence has sparked the scientific imagination since the 4th century BCE, when the Greek philosopher and naturalist Aristotle documented its glow in his treatise, Historia Animalium. Marveling at the enchanting blue-green lights emitted by jellyfish, he suggested that the radiant displays were a form of communication or defense. Ever since then, the mystery of bioluminescence has piqued the interest of many, including naturalists like Sir Francis Bacon and Robert Boyle. Even Dutch scientist Anton van Leeuwenhoek, famed for his work with microscopes, turned his lens towards bioluminescent organisms in the 17th century, describing the tiny animalcules he observed in water as living fireworks. But it wasn't until the late 19th century, in the dimly lit laboratory of Raphael Dubois, a French pharmacist, that a mechanism and name was given to the phenomenon. Dissecting fireflies and click beetles, then turning towards bioluminescent clams, he concluded that this light was not caused by a single component, but rather by the interaction of two separate molecules, a protein, or more specifically, an enzyme, and another small molecule called a substrate. With this discovery, Dubois unveiled the chemical basis of bioluminescence. He named the enzyme luciferase and the small molecule substrate luciferin. This dynamic duo is responsible for the ethereal radiance of clams, click beetles, and fireflies, as well as thousands of other organisms that glow in the dark. As with any other chemical reaction, bioluminescence requires energy. This energy is precious, so for any animal, fungus, plant, or bacterium to dedicate energy to generating light indicates that it must be extremely important for survival in one way or another. There must be an intrinsic biological drive to make light, just as there is a drive to seek it. The biological impetus for light production is rooted in its evolutionary advantages, which explain why bioluminescence is found in organisms of all shapes and sizes. Many species use light to attract mates and coordinate group activities. Bioluminescence is also a potent defense mechanism. Some organisms use light to deter predators. The luciferase enzyme, for instance, is rapidly activated when an organism senses a threat. The resulting burst of light startles or distracts predators, offering the bioluminescent organism the chance to evade capture. Despite how common glowing creatures are, the evolution of bioluminescence and luciferases remains unclear. With so many different organisms that produce light, we might assume that luciferases come from a single common ancestor. With more and more research into the origin of luciferases, however, it has become apparent that even bioluminescent organisms with shared ancestry have evolved to produce light at different times and in different ways. Jing K. Wang, a chemist formerly at MIT and currently at Northwestern University, recently set out to study the evolution of luciferases in beetles, which include the ubiquitous firefly. Specifically, he was interested in Photinus pyralis, commonly called the Big Dipper firefly, which is found across North America. Determining where the luciferase gene was located in the Big Dipper's DNA, Wang and his team found that the gene was likely the result of a duplication event, when one copy of a gene turned into two copies during cell division. As duplication events occur, the additional copy of a gene can turn into a protein that, with just a few small changes, can have an entirely new purpose. In the case of the Big Dipper, the researchers predicted that this is what happened with luciferase. An unrelated gene had transformed into a protein that made the Big Dipper into a glowing insect. But understanding how luciferases arose in one organism doesn't fully answer the question of when this event of bioluminescence occurred in evolutionary history. To investigate this, Wang and his team gathered DNA from two more glowing beetles. Ignilater luminosus, a species of click beetle that is distantly related to the Big Dipper, and Aquatica lateralis, also known as the hike firefly, another species of firefly that is more closely related to the Big Dipper, though still separated by about 100 million years of evolutionary distance. By investigating luciferase genes from these two additional beetles, Wang and his team hope to determine whether these bioluminescent insects came from the same ancestor or if their light-making abilities developed independently, perhaps millions of years apart. They discovered that in the more closely related hike firefly, the luciferase gene was found in a similar location to that of the Big Dipper. This indicated that these two fireflies gained their bioluminescence from the same ancestor. In the click beetle, however, the luciferase gene was farther away, suggesting that bioluminescence had emerged via another evolutionary tree. Aside from beetles, it's estimated that more than 700 genera of animals are bioluminescent. With so many different luciferases, fully understanding how each one evolved is a nearly impossible feat. Scientists believe, however, that there are at least 90 examples in nature of luciferases evolving independently, meaning there is no single common ancestor that the very first bioluminescence can be traced back to. This type of convergent evolution is seen in many aspects of life, but none as captivating as a glowing insect or a gleaming squid hovering over the ocean floor. With around 80% of known bioluminescent organisms residing in the sea, it is clear that bioluminescence favors specific environmental niches where light is particularly beneficial. And given how much it pops up in nature, it seems to be an evolutionarily easy process, arising from changes in proteins, where light is a lucky byproduct of other adaptations. Despite a limited understanding of how bioluminescence evolved, as far as scientists know, all luciferases share a common feature. They consume oxygen, hinting at an underlying function that may have had nothing to do with creating light. Indeed, many researchers have proposed that this extraordinary ability to produce light may have evolved to eliminate oxygen or reactive oxygen species, ROS, from inside an organism's body. ROS are tiny, highly charged particles that behave like chemical sparks and can damage DNA and proteins if left unchecked. The notion that bioluminescence might have evolved as a mechanism to eliminate oxygen, which can give rise to ROS or to eliminate ROS themselves, paints a vivid picture of the intricate dance of life. Luciferases not only illuminate the depths of our oceans, but also shed light on the ingenious ways in which organisms have evolved to navigate the challenges presented by their environments. To us humans, bioluminescence is a mesmerizing light show and a fascinating example of how proteins produce the most unusual features in some of the most mysterious creatures. Yet we are not merely enchanted bystanders. That's because scientists have used the bioluminescent properties of luciferases to make some of the most important discoveries in biology. By adding these proteins to living cells, for instance, they have tracked the location and movement of minuscule cellular components, illuminating a world of molecular architecture that was elusive not so long ago. One major application for luciferases has been cancer research. Tumors growing in laboratory animals are often tagged with one of the many luciferase enzymes found in nature. By monitoring the amount of emitted light, the growth or spread of these tumors can be precisely tracked. Moreover, this strategy can help scientists record how a tumor responds to an experimental drug in real time, without having to extract the tumor from the animal subject. Bioluminescence has even been deployed in the fight against pollution. Recently, E. coli bacteria were modified to produce a version of luciferase only when challenged by environmental stresses. The bioluminescent signals that the bacteria emit have been used to detect cancer-causing pollutants, DNA-damaging molecules, and toxic heavy metals like arsenic or antimony. From the enchanting glow of fireflies to the mysterious displays of deep-sea squid, luminous creatures have always inspired awe and wonder. This has only been enhanced by the discovery of the proteins involved and by our growing understanding of how these proteins emerged. As we look ahead to new scientific breakthroughs, there is no doubt that bioluminescent proteins will guide the way. A gentle glow of a firefly on a warm Indiana night reminds us of the creativity of nature and of the creativity of humans, too, as we harness the most brilliant tools from our environment to decipher our world and shape its future. Rethinking the Red Planet. Observations from space and experiments on Earth have helped astronomers retell Mars's story. The story of the Red Planet may be due for a revision. At one time, scientists thought that Mars turned red when it was arid and dry, when its rocks, rich in iron, reacted to oxygen in the air. That reaction formed rust, the theory went, which was broken down into dust and spread by wind over billions of years until the planet's whole surface was covered in scarlet. But a February 2025 study in Nature Communications instead suggests that the planet's color traces back to a time when water covered much of Mars's surface. After reacting to the iron and oxygen in the planet's rocks and air, that water receded, then disappeared, leaving rust behind to break down and spread. One of the most exciting aspects of this research was how it contradicted the prevailing theory about Mars's red coloration, says Adomas Valentinas, a Brown University researcher who participated in the study while at the University of Bern in Switzerland. The origins of the red dust on Mars have profound implications to astronomers and to anyone pondering whether life could have existed on the planet. The fact that iron and oxygen form rust, or iron oxide, chemically speaking, is not up for debate. But there are many kinds of rust, and knowing which kinds formed at which points in the planet's history can provide a lot of information about its past habitability. Since earlier observations showed no clear signs of water on Mars, researchers initially assumed that the planet's particular flavor of iron oxide was hematite, which is waterless and forms when iron reacts to oxygen and air. However, newer observations have led some scientists to another conclusion. Captured in part by NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, as well as its Curiosity, Pathfinder, and Opportunity rovers, these observations suggest that the planet's color more closely matches that of ferrohydrite, a water-containing iron oxide formed in cool, wet conditions. Therefore, the scientists suggest that the rust must have been created when the planet still had water on its surface. To support their theory, the researchers ground different types of iron oxides into grains of dust as tiny as 1/100th of a human hair and compared them to images of dust on Mars. While scientists had long thought the reddish hue came from hematite, a waterless form of rust, our research showed that it actually comes from ferrohydrite, a water-containing rusty mineral, Valentinus says. Of course, there's only one way to conclusively prove if the water theory of Mars's coloration is true, and that's by testing actual dust samples from the planet. NASA has already collected such samples, and both NASA and the European Space Agency, or ESA, will continue to collect more, with the current samples scheduled to arrive on Earth in the mid to late 2030s. Some of these samples, already collected by NASA's Perseverance rover and awaiting return to Earth, include dust. Once we get those precious samples into the lab, we'll be able to measure exactly how much ferrohydrite the dust contains, said Colin Wilson, an ESA scientist, in a statement. Only then will we know the true story behind Mars's surface. If a whale could talk. A multidisciplinary team of scientists hopes to crack the code of sperm whale clicks, potentially enabling humans to understand them. In the 1960s, researchers Roger Payne and Scott McVeigh discovered that whales sing to one another. Payne, scientist though he was, missed neither the romance nor the possibilities of this discovery. In 1970, he produced Songs of the Humpback Whale, an album with five tracks of hauntingly beautiful humpback songs. The album became a catalyst for the Save the Whales movement, which led to the end of whaling in the U.S. and eventually a global ban that saved many whale populations from extinction. Payne died in 2023, but not before inspiring a new generation of scientists to study the voices of whales. This time, though, their plan is even bolder. These scientists hope to decipher the meaning of whale sounds to gain insight into what life is like for another species. And in so doing, help save not only whales, but possibly the rest of us as well. Before his death, Payne was an advisor to Project SETI, an interdisciplinary scientific and conservation initiative with a self-described mission to listen to and translate the communication of sperm whales. Founded in 2020 by David Gruber, a marine biologist who focuses on animal communication and climate science, SETI, which stands for Cetacean Translation Initiative, uses the latest advances in minimally invasive robotics, underwater recording technology, and machine learning to capture and analyze tremendous amounts of sperm whale vocalizations. Rather than singing to one another like humpbacks, sperm whales communicate using groups of clicks, called codas, which have long been known to carry information about the identity and clan membership of individual whales. However, using artificial intelligence, SETI scientists are learning that those codas are more complex than previously thought. In research published in May 2024 in the journal Nature Communications, the SETI team found that subtle changes in tempo, called rubato, and extra clicks, called ornamentation, combine with more basic codas to form a much larger set of potential sounds. Gaspar Bigas, lead linguist on the SETI team, thinks this may suggest that more meaning than simply identity markers is being transmitted through this communication system. This communication system looks really structured, he says. There are many discrete symbolic features there, but we don't know yet what it means. The data collected and tools developed by Project SETI will soon be an enormous boon to whale research. But will it enable humans to translate whale communications? Luke Rendell thinks not. Rendell studies learning, behavior, and communication in marine animals, and in much of SETI's work builds on his decades of research on whale culture. While the SETI discoveries are important, Rendell doesn't think those whale sounds much resemble human language. The most frequent sounds cataloged so far are codas that indicate membership in a particular clan. The subtle variations in rhythm and tempo are riffs on those identity markers. This is likely analogous to humans clapping in sync or playing drums in rhythm. Musical or rhythmic bonding rituals exist in virtually all human cultures, Rendell notes. The more familiar we get with one another, the better we play that rhythm together, he says. In other words, these elaborate riffs on a basic set of codas may just be a kind of social bonding. Still, they aren't trivial. Bonding is extremely important for these social animals who, Rendell says, depend very critically on each other for things like defending against predators or caring for each other's calves when they dive to feed. Although it's an intriguing idea, the group's goal is not to be able to actually talk to whales. I don't think anybody on the team has anything they want to say to a whale, Gruber says. Instead, the goal is to use the communications they analyze to better understand the lives of whales, and use that understanding to guide conversations and decisions about conservation. Maybe we don't have all the answers in and of ourselves, within our culture, within our country, within our species, says Shane Garrow, a field biology lead for Project CET. Maybe there's some learning that can be done across these boundaries. That's my hope for CETI. In the end, the hope for the entire CETI team is that their efforts will inspire the public to be more supportive of conservation efforts worldwide, not just for whales, but for all life on Earth. A natural approach to pain relief. A new study shows that nature can soothe pain, reducing the activity in pain-perceiving regions in the brain. As it turns out, nature's soothing effects are much stronger and much easier to access than traditionally thought, according to a March 2025 study in Nature Communications. Monitoring people's brain perception, pain perception, or nociception, While immersed in nature, the research reveals that outdoor settings are an analgesic for the brain, providing pain relief through sight and sound alone. From past studies, we know that being in contact with nature is associated with this very broad range of beneficial effects, says Maximilian Steininger, a study author and a PhD student at the University of Vienna. But whether that range includes an actual pain-relieving response, represented by reduced activity in the pain-perceiving regions in the brain, was previously debated. To understand this better, the study authors administered shocks to dozens of participants in increasing intensities while taking MRI scans of their brains. Once a participant described a shock level as unbearable, the researchers dialed back the intensity and measured the participant's brain activity as they received a series of additional reduced intensity shocks. Since it wasn't practical to move an MRI machine out into the middle of a forest, the team brought the forest into the machine. They put screens inside the MRI scanners that displayed three different types of images. The first showed a nature scene, a lake surrounded by trees and hills. The second showed an urban scene, a lake surrounded by skyscrapers. And the third showed an indoor scene, an office desk. While the first was accompanied by audio of birdsong, waves, and wind, the second and third were paired with the sounds of empty traffic and construction and of office computers and fans. Although the participants showed similar brain activity while viewing the urban and indoor scenes, their reactions were dulled while viewing the nature scene. The reduced responses were concentrated in the thalamus and in several other regions of the brain that are associated with nociception. The results surprised Steininger, who had assumed that the natural pain relief reported in previous studies was a placebo effect, in which participants self-reported a reduced sensation of pain because of their belief in nature's benefits, not because of the activity in their pain-perceiving regions. "We found the exact opposite," he says. "It's not in line with what we know from placebo analgesia." It's difficult to say why nature reduces pain perception, though Steininger suspects that the features of nature, such as the patterns of leaf shadows moving on the forest floor, capture our attention, reducing our ability to perceive painful stimuli. Indeed, previous studies have shown that captured attention can also result in reduced nociceptive responses in the brain. My suggestion would be that what was seen here was a very pronounced distraction effect, Steininger says. The results of the study have practical applications for hospitals and healthcare facilities, which could reduce their patients' pain by incorporating nature, whether real or virtual, into their therapies and treatments. Environmental aspects are important, and they should be considered when we talk about approaches to pain management, Steininger says. We have run out of time for today's episode of Discover. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.